Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella. As mentioned, my name is Johnny Nazarian. I am the Education Program Manager here at Cancer Care, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Liver Cancer Treatment Update. This program is supported by ESI Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now to start, I just want to go over how many people are on the call today. We have over 200 participants, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from Canada and the United Kingdom, so it is a global call. We are delighted to have you all on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. So now we're going to move to our first speaker. Our first speaker is Ahmed Omar Kaseb, and Dr. Kaseb is the John E. and Dorothy J. Harris Professorship in Gastrointestinal Cancer Research Member, National Hepatobiliary Task Force, tenured professor and director, hepatocellular carcinoma, my apologies, program director at MD Anderson, HCC Spore, editor-in-chief, Journal of Hepatocellular Carcinoma, Department of Gastrointestinal Medical Oncology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Right. And Dr. Kaseb will be discussing an overview of liver cancer, including current standard of care, new treatment approaches, clinical trial updates, how research increases your treatment options, the role of radioembolization, controlling symptoms, treatment, side effects, discomfort, and pain, as well as guidelines to prepare for telehealth/telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes.
Hi, everyone. It's an honor to be among all of you today. Can you guys hear me well?
Yes.
All right. So sorry about the technical issues here. So I'm going to talk to you today, first off, about the liver cancer, hepatocellular carcinoma in general. So this is cancer of the liver cell. So we, in the liver, we either have cancer of the liver cell, the red tissue versus bile duct cancers. And in terms of standard of care approaches, once we get the diagnosis of liver cancer, it all depends on two factors. One factor is the tumor stage itself. The other factor is how healthy the liver function is, because a lot of times we actually have two diseases in one. In one hand, we have the cancer. In the other hand, we have the underlying scarring tissue, or what we call cirrhosis. So if we do have a small tumor size and healthy liver, then we may be able to go for surgical resection. However, if the liver cirrhosis is very advanced, the cancer is still small, liver transplant may be an option to get rid of both conditions in one shot, the cancer and the cirrhosis. However, if the tumors are multiple or the tumor is very large beyond resection, beyond surgery or transplant, then the next in line is, can we do localized therapy? And by that I mean either radiation from outside the body if it is within one field, or localized therapy with a catheter treatment from the groin up, like having a hard cath, but we go to the liver and directly inject chemotherapy or radiation spheres. And if the tumors are much smaller, we can do ablation different forms of ablation are available, either heat or freezing or hysterectomy. So there are multiple forms of ablation if the tumors are very small. However, if the tumors are beyond that and they are either involving the veins in the liver or outside the liver, stage 4, then we go for what we call systemic therapy, meaning something by vein or mouth to go wherever blood goes. And then, of course, depending on the multidisciplinary tumor board discussion and so on, sometimes we do mix and match. We do localized and systemic depending on the very specific case scenario. I'd like also to talk about some new treatment approaches evolving in the field. So I talked briefly about the systemic therapy, which is, you know, either by vein or mouth, including immunotherapy to stimulate our own immune cells to attack the tumors, and that's why it is more tolerable, or pills. They attack certain proteins on the tumor itself, and they are taken by mouth. So this is systemic therapy. There are new approaches there in terms of new approvals. So last few months, we have witnessed the approval of nivolumab and ipilimumab, Opdivo and Yervoy. Also, the localized therapy combined with systemic therapy is considered a new approach. Also, new approaches with immunotherapy in terms of vaccine strategies, not approved yet, but they are still in the clinical trial arena, which is a nice segue now to talk about the clinical trial updates. So in terms of immunotherapy approaches, there is a lot of advances recently in terms of immunotherapy approaches, not just by vein, which we are very used to, but also cancer vaccines. So those could be injections, could be also in the tumor itself, intratumoral injections, to stimulate the immune environment and prepare the tumors to respond better to immunotherapy. Also, some approaches, what we call T-cell therapy. So we take our patient's own immune cells, load them with antibodies against specific proteins of the tumor themselves, and then give the patients back their immune cells. And that's another approach in clinical trials as well. And of course, we always have clinical trial approaches where we actually can also mix and match. So clinical trial approaches combining local and systemic therapy. So combining the intra-arterial, what we talked about, the catheter treatment inside of the artery all the way to the liver, injecting chemotherapy or radiation spheres, and this combined with immunotherapy, for example. So that's another clinical trial approach. So we talked about cancer vaccines to stimulate the immune system, or T-cell therapy to take your own immune cells and give them back to the patients after loading them with antibodies against tumor proteins, and combining localized and systemic therapy approaches. And there are also some radiofrequency fields, you know, trials evolving as well. Again, the same concept to make sure that we attack the tumors with a different strategy, and sometimes they are also combined with systemic therapy treatments, intravenous or pills. I'd like also to expand a little bit about the role of the radioembolization, or what we call yttrium-90 or Y90. So I'm sure a lot of patients and families heard about that approach, and it is very promising. It is effective in a lot of cases. It's complementary to what we do also in terms of immunotherapy in other cases. So all depends on the multidisciplinary team managing the patient specific case scenario to decide if this is a case for radioembolization alone, Y90 alone, if it is single tumor, the size is favorable, liver functions are favorable. In some cases, we only do radioembolization alone. Or if the tumor is more extensive, and in that case, we focus on systemic therapy, and the role of radioembolization could come at a later time if it is a very focused area of remaining active disease, for example. Next, I'd like to talk about controlling the cancer symptoms and treatment of side effects and discomfort and pain. So I'd like to start with talking about the tumor-related symptoms. So in general, our liver tumors could stretch the capsule, and that can cause pressure effects and pain, referred pain to the shoulder. Also, if the tumor is outside the liver itself, inside of the vein, that can block off the blood supply, the blood vessels coming from the abdominal cavity. So the blocking of the vein by the tumor can lead to fluid retention in the abdomen, what we call ascites, or some fluid accumulation in the abdomen, and also could be symptoms related to the tumor outside the liver itself in terms of stage 4, so tumors in the lung, causing shortness of breath or, you know, symptoms or chest symptoms, or in the bones causing pain, for example, and disfigurement. So controlling symptoms related to the tumors depends exactly on the location of where this symptom is coming from, the size of the tumor associated with this symptom. So for example, if it is in the liver itself, systemic therapy can help, and that's a sign of response to systemic therapy, that patients can start feeling better in terms of the pressure effects if it is pain, for example. However, if it is related to a specific spot in the portal vein, for example, or outside the liver in a bone or muscle or area causing pain and discomfort, then multidisciplinary team approach will also kick in, and we can talk to radiation teams about the role of radiation in that case, or if it is localized to the liver, also about catheter treatments in certain cases to control the pain, if it is stretching the capsule. All of these things are done in the setting of multidisciplinary team approaches and what we call palliative treatments to control the symptoms related to the tumor. There is also another kind of symptoms, which are the treatment side effects. So those are very specific to the drugs we use to treat patients with liver cancer. So in these cases, we adjust the doses. Sometimes we give a break. Sometimes we rely on symptom management by medications. Of course, pain medication in conjunction with our supportive care team. This is also part of the multidisciplinary team to control the pain, control any treatment side effects such as nausea or loose bowel movement or any other symptoms related to the specific drug we're using. Sometimes it raises the blood pressure, certain medications. So it's a multidisciplinary team approach depending on what kind of side effect are we encountering and how can we tackle that if it is something that we do with pills control the symptoms, or for example, if it is related to blood pressure, higher blood pressure, then we reach out to the cardiology or primary care teams to help with adjusting the medications as well. And of course, we work with our hepatology colleagues as well to control the underlying symptoms of cirrhosis, which I mentioned earlier. A lot of patients have cirrhosis or liver scarring as well. And in these cases, they could have fluid retention. They could have some what we call encephalopathy because of high ammonia in the blood. So these patients will be managed under hepatology team guidance there controlling these symptoms, for example, with water pills to control the fluid retention, or lactulose and other drugs to control encephalopathy and so on. Also, a lot of times, if patients have advanced cirrhosis and high pressure in the portal system, they can have varices or varicose veins in the esophagus or stomach. So our hepatology and GI teams can do endoscopies to manage these side effects as well. And lastly, I'd like to talk about some preparation. A lot of us now in clinic use telehealth or telemedicine, where we can do virtual visits by video or by phones. And in these cases, we always want to make sure that our patients and their families have the necessary technology to be able to keep up with that. More importantly, also to be prepared for it, because it's different from in person. So a lot of times our team can call ahead of time the patients and their families to make sure not not only we have the technology, but also to prepare them for the visit. So if they have a list of questions or any discussion points, we can prepare them and be ready to take some notes during the call. So this is also something that our patients and treating physicians are getting accustomed to in recently. And this is something that emerged and was expanded during COVID time, but our patients and their families love it because sometimes it's hard for them to keep up with frequent visitations, and especially for some patients who are kind of stable, they are getting the same treatment, and the visitation by the telehealth is actually beneficial to them and saving them, you know, the travel and expenses and so on. So I'd like to stop here, and I'm ready for any questions. We're all looking forward to answering any questions you might have today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cassette. That was just a superb presentation. You covered a lot of information in a short amount of time, so I'm sure there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Again, thank you very much. Now, Ms. Bearden, Diana Bearden, is an oncology dietitian at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And Ms. Bearden will be discussing the role of the oncology dietitian, nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential, not only in the tolerance to treatment, but your quality of life. Your diet might be modified throughout your cancer treatment to assist with managing any side effects that you may experience. Some potential side effects may include a decrease in appetite, constipation, feeling full quickly, nausea, diarrhea, vomiting. But a dietitian is part of your healthcare team and can help provide you information on your individual needs, specifically things like calorie, protein, and fluid needs, and information on any diet modification. Typically, there is an increased need in protein. And so working with your dietitian, she or he can individualize that plan for you to help you meet your goals. Each person responds differently to treatment, so please communicate with us as soon as you notice a change or you're struggling in a different way. That way we can help you sooner and get you on track for meeting your goals. In general, we don't want patients to lose a significant amount of weight. Weight loss, even if you're obese, can impact the way you feel. It can impact your lean muscle mass. It can even put you at risk of falls and maybe delayed wound healing and maybe even a delay in treatment. So our goal is to work and support you through this time. There are medications to assist with side effects, so please talk with your healthcare team so that you know how to use those medications, when to use them so that you feel better and you're tolerating your treatment better. If there are foods that are giving you challenges, please reach out to your dietitian. It can also help with adjusting your diet to make sure that you get the goals that you need to get to meet your needs. Hydration is something that oftentimes is overlooked, and maintaining hydration is so important. Dehydration can actually amplify side effects such as nausea, fatigue, make you feel dizzy, maybe have a headache. Fluids, anything that's liquid at room temperature. And in general, you need about 8 to 10 8-ounce glasses a day. Some suggestions would be water, milk, maybe even juice. Again, your unique needs, talk with your healthcare team about how much fluid. In closing, there are several members of the healthcare team dedicated to you, so knowing how to reach us is so important so that we can get back with you as soon as possible. Thank you for letting me be part of today's workshop. I'm going to pass the line back over to Carolyn.
All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was just a wonderful presentation. I know there will be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A, and we are actually going to move on to our next speaker, who is Daniel LaPook. Mr. LaPook is an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and Mr. LaPook will be going over communicating with your healthcare team about your financial concerns, Cancer Care's free programs and services, including our helpline, as well as our website that has information on how to contact us, including our resources. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Mr. LaPook.
Thank you so much. And hi, everyone. Again, I'm Daniel LaPook. I'm one of the oncology social workers here at Cancer Care. And I'm excited to be here with you all to provide an overview of our services. We are a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. And to become connected with any of our programs, the best thing is to reach out to our National Hope Line, which is 800-813-4673, to speak with a member of our social services team, including oncology social workers. And again, that number is 1-800-813-4673. Once someone calls and is connected to an oncology social worker, we conduct an assessment of needs that help us determine how we could best offer support. We can always connect callers with extensive resources that help address their concerns, whether they be financial, emotional, practical, or logistical. The person might be eligible for our resource navigation service, where they would be paired with someone to help develop a comprehensive list of organizations and programs that can offer effective support. We do have individual counseling in New York and New Jersey, and support groups that typically meet through Zoom in New York and New Jersey as well. Our online groups that meet through a message board format are available to anyone in the U.S., Puerto Rico, and U.S. territories. There are groups for patients, caregivers, and those who are bereaved, education workshops like today. We have publications that help provide reliable information by cancer type and on general topics like clinical trials, navigating grief and loss, and how to speak with children and teens about cancer. So we always, you know, encourage having open dialogues and conversations with your medical team about your financial concerns. We are there to help support by connecting people to different resources and maybe develop tips and tools for how to advocate for their needs within the system as well. So we hope to hear from you. Again, our hope line is 1-800-813-4673. And thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Mr. LaPook. That was just an excellent and comprehensive overview of all the programs, services, and resources that we offer here at Cancer Care. Thank you so much again. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay, and here's our first question. It's for Mr. LaPook. It is, where can I start to look for support groups? How specific can they be, and are they offered for loved ones?
Yeah, so support groups are a wonderful way to connect with other people who can relate to your experience and then help reduce feelings of isolation. So there are groups that are specific for patients, caregivers, and those who are bereaved, and also groups that are specific to the type of cancer that one might be navigating or caring for. At Cancer Care, as I mentioned before, we have groups that meet through Zoom in New York and New Jersey, and then throughout the country for those that meet up through a message board. If you are connected with a hospital or a medical provider, I would ask the team there if they know of any local support groups. Sometimes there are groups that are actually run in the hospital in person, so it really depends on what you're looking for. So I would recommend, you know, connecting with your hospital social worker, patient navigator, nurse navigator, or doctor. Or you can always give us a call at Cancer Care, and we can help you find local options. So if you call our Hope Line at 800-813-4673, even if you're outside of New York or New Jersey, we could do some research and see what might be more local to your area and based off of what you're looking for.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. LaPook. Now we have a question for Dr. Kaseb. Can surgery lead to cure if the cancer is caught early enough?
Yes. So the short answer is yes. If it is caught early enough, Curative options include surgery if the liver is healthy enough to undergo surgery and the tumor is small and in favorable location, or liver transplant if the tumor is not healthy enough, and transplant can actually provide cure because it can get rid of the cancer and the underlying cirrhosis which led to cancer in the first place. Also, recently there has been some approaches that proved to be also curative aside from surgery. So for example, if we have one single tumor, 3 centimeter, not amenable for surgery because of the scarring of the liver, not amenable for transplant because of health condition, for example, and then we do high dose radiation or some localized therapy such as ablation or yttrium-90 radioembolization or chemoembolization, injecting chemotherapy through the catheter. So a lot of these, you know, treatments, if this tumor is small enough and the dose is effective, can also offer eradication of the tumor, which would look dead. It's not going to disappear on the scan, but these treatments approaches can offer what we call a definitive approach or curative approach, localized therapy. And that goes back to the importance of the multidisciplinary team approach to identify candidates for these treatments.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kasab. Another question for you from one of our participants. It's asking if any of the treatments you mentioned could they be used for liver mets from breast cancer, or are they used strictly just for liver cancer?
Yeah, it's a good question. So in terms of the approach, for example, including the catheter treatment, right? So when we do the catheter treatment from the growing up, like having a hard cath, we go inside the liver, inject either chemotherapy or radiation spheres, yttrium-90. Treatment rationale there is the fact that liver cancer, hepatocellular carcinoma, is very vascular. If you look at the images, they look bright on the images. And it is mainly supplied by the hepatic artery, the arteries in the liver, not the veins. So that's why we rely on this fact to go inside with the catheter, kill the tumor, block the artery in some cases, and we rely on the fact that the tumor is mainly supplied by the arteries. And if we do this, we're going to kill the tumor and leave the normal liver, which is supplied by the vein, in a little more intact and with less side effects. However, most of these metastases from outside the liver, for example, from breast or colon, most of them are actually supplied by the vein, not the artery. So they don't look vascular like liver cancer. So in these cases, unfortunately, it is not going to respond the same like liver cancer. So these treatments are mainly focused on liver cancer because of this vascular phenomenon.
Thank you so much. Another question for you, is MASH related to any risk of liver cancer? Should patients consider GLP-1s to prevent progression?
That's an excellent question, and of course timely, right? A lot of patients are taking these drugs. So theoretically, we think that, you know, because the issue of the fatty liver and the scars in the liver and all of that could be addressed by weight loss, GLP-1, all of these drugs can help patients lose weight and improve their liver functions. So theoretically, we think that they are going to be helpful. However, you have to consult with your physician first to make sure that your condition will allow that. So whenever I get asked this question by my patients, I defer the answer to the hepatology colleagues, because the liver specialists would be the best ones to prescribe and monitor patients with liver cancer taking concomitantly these medications. So the short answer is, could be possibly helpful. However, it depends on your specific case scenario, and that's why we rely on this multidisciplinary team approach to have our hepatology team weigh in.
Thank you so much. And another question for you, Dr. Kasab, is CAR T cell therapy being considered for HCC?
Yes, and that's part of what I was talking about, the approach where we take your own, you know, immune cells and, you know, rely on the immune cell loading with the antibodies against specific proteins. So CAR-T is among this category of the innovative immunotherapy approaches. They are still in clinical trial approaches, different stages depending on the specific study. Some studies are still in the baby steps in phase one. Some studies advanced to beyond phase one. Some studies are using it single agent. Some studies are using it with immunotherapy. So until now, the answer is it is very innovative. We are very motivated about using it in clinical trials. However, it's not approved yet. So, of course, if you have an access to clinical trial with this approach, I would encourage you to look into it, and the oncologist can evaluate your candidacy for it because it is an innovative and promising approach.
Great. Thank you so much. And an additional question for you is just a general question. Should I avoid nutritional supplements during chemotherapy? Are there any general guidelines or recommendations when it comes to supplements and vitamins?
So the multivitamins are fine with systemic therapy. Sometimes with radiation, they worry about the sensitization and patients could get more side effects. So specific radiation fields and radiation doses, you need to consult with your radiation oncologist. In terms of immunotherapy and other drugs, it is safe to take multivitamins. However, additional nutritional supplements, you really have to discuss them in particular. What is it composed of with the team, the dietitian, the oncologist, to make sure that we know what they are, because sometimes we call them nutritional supplements and natural medicine, but some of them could actually be detrimental to the liver function itself. So you really have to be careful. I like, you know, the fact that you're asking, and I always encourage my patients to ask and show me what they want to take, so that way we can run it by the team to make sure it is safe.
Great. Thank you so much. And Dr. Kaseb, another question for you. Is ablation the best option for treatment when surgery is not possible?
It depends on the size and the location. So, for example, if there's a single tumor, 3 centimeter, and it is not amenable for surgery due to any reason, then ablation could be a good option depending on the location. Because if it is close to the surface, certain ablation techniques would be risky, and the tumor could rupture if it is close to a big vessel. It acts like a heat sink. If it is close to a bile duct, it could rupture into the bile duct and cause infection and abscess. Certain ablation techniques. So that's why ablation type depends on the location and the size itself. If it is a single tumor beyond the safe ablation, then we think about the catheter treatments, either injection chemotherapy or radiation spheres with the yttrium 90. So that's why, again, it goes back to the multidisciplinary team approach that we discussed earlier, which is a pillar in managing liver cancer patients.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Kaseb. And another question for you. Are there clinical trials that look at preventing cirrhosis from leading to liver cancer?
There are some clinical trials, and actually some drugs got approved recently in the hepatology area to reverse the scarring tissue of the liver, to reverse it from advanced stages to early fibrosis. So fibrosis is the scarring, and there are, you know, drugs. Some of them are approved. Some of them are in clinical trials. So I would encourage you, if you were told that your liver has got some fibrosis, you don't have cancer or a family member, to talk to your hepatologist and primary care doctors, because there are approved drugs that can reverse the fibrosis and the scarring, and that in turn should help in lowering the risk for developing liver cancer.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kaseb. Another question for you. Is it common to do chemotherapy to shrink the tumor size before a transplant?
Yeah, that's a great question, and this is what we call downsizing. So this is also true for liver resection. So if the tumor is not small enough to undergo surgery and it is risky, to get listed for transplant, if it's a certain size or certain number of tumors, then yes, we do treatments with, you know, systemic and local therapy. So local therapy, we talked about intra-arterial with the catheter treatment, ablation. We talked about systemic therapy, including immunotherapy and other targeted therapies. So all of these drugs can help, either when used alone or in combination with local and systemic therapy in certain cases, to shrink the tumors and then enable either surgery or enable listing for liver transplant. So this is definitely some of the approaches that we adopt, and we do it in a multidisciplinary manner in conjunction with our surgery team and our transplant team, and it's called downsizing.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Kaseb. We have another question for you. It is, what is child PU classification in HCC? What does it mean if my status is class B?
Yeah, so just like we grade the cancer based on staging systems 1, 2, 3, 4, we also grade the status of the underlying liver disease. And the scoring system commonly used here is called child PU classification. So it's either A, which is normal, versus B, which is kind of middle, and then C, which is very advanced. So C is very advanced, you know, poor liver reserve, and in these cases, it is not safe to do local or systemic therapy, any treatment can actually push the liver into failure. B is kind of in the middle, but not all class B are the same, because B itself could be different grades. So that's why it is one of these areas that the management of patients with child PUB is strictly based on multidisciplinary discussions between hepatology, oncology, and people involved with the management, such as interventional radiology if we're thinking procedures, or radiation therapy if we're thinking about local therapy with radiation treatment, because it's a big spectrum, child PUB. Some of them would be deemed safe to undergo aggressive therapy. Some of them would not. So that's one of the things, that it's a wide spectrum, really depending on the multidisciplinary discussion to make sure it is safe to undergo systemic or localized therapy.
Great. Thank you so much. And another question for you. Could you please discuss how to prepare for a transplant? I'm currently waiting on a liver transplant.
Yes, so in terms of waiting on the list for transplant, two things will need to go, you know, hand in hand. So one of them is, of course, following up with the transplant team to make sure that everything is clear. Sometimes we have to get clearance from cardiology and lung teams and so on to make sure the body is going to handle this major surgery. So we do a lot of things like heart cath sometimes and other procedures to make sure the body is going to be able to handle it, and then we get the patient listed for transplant. However, there is also in parallel, you should be following up with the oncology team to make sure what we call bridging to transplant, meaning that we have to make sure that the tumors are under control while the patient is waiting for liver transplant. So bridging therapy to transplant includes localized therapy, includes also systemic therapy in certain cases, because of course, transplant doesn't happen overnight. It takes time to get to transplant. In certain states, it takes up to a year and a half or two to get to transplant. So every 3 months, you get a scan, and both teams will review it, the transplant team and also the oncology team. And the oncology team role there and the job is to make sure the tumors are remaining under control. So if the tumors are still looking dead, controlled, we continue the same therapy, whether it is systemic therapy with anything like pills, for example, or intravenous therapies, or localized therapy approaches to make sure to eliminate the active areas that appeared on the scans. So during the transplantation, preparation is two angles. One is the transplant team angle, the other one is the oncology angle, and they go hand in hand, part of one team, and everything depends on the every 3 month scans that we always get while waiting for the transplant.
Great, thank you so much. And following up on that question, can you please discuss any risks or side effects associated with the transplant and that surgery?
Yeah, so of course it's a major decision, right? It's a major surgery. So I always ask my patients before making the decision to meet in person with the transplant teams. They actually have access to major, you know, teams of social workers and nutritionists and so on to make sure that all of these angles are covered, to make sure that the patient will have enough social support and all of that. So it is, technicality of the procedure itself is one thing that, you know, you have to be evaluated for it to make sure the body is going to handle it, but also the patient themselves will have to discuss one-on-one with the transplant team if this is what they really want, because it is still life-changing experience. After transplant, you go on immune suppression to prevent rejecting the new organ, right? So in these cases, you go on certain drugs, immune suppression drugs for life. Patients are going to be more prone to infections. Of course, the benefit will outweigh the risk there because it is a life-saving procedure. But you really have to have this discussion with the transplant surgeon, with the social workers and the team to make sure that this is something that you could commit to. So it is a major surgery. It's a life-changing experience. So that's why the transplant team usually have this multidisciplinary transplant team to walk the patient through all of these angles.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kassab. Thank you for answering all those questions. I now would like to ask our speakers to provide takeaways. We're going to start with Dr. Kassab and then Mr. Lapook.
So I really am very happy that I was able to be with you all today, because end of the day, our patients and their families and their communities are the ones who are dealing with this kind of cancer every single day. So I'm really happy that we were able today to give you this multidisciplinary kind of take, you know, what is this cancer is all about, how we treat it. Our social workers and dietitian team also talked to you about their angles. So I really think that the journey here, this is a marathon, not a sprint. So I really think you should take the advantage of all the multidisciplinary team members available to you, also the resources that are available to you and to your family member if you are a patient. And I always encourage patients and their families to ask about these resources from day one and continue to ask about them to make sure that they have the support they needed.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kassab. Just a very meaningful takeaway, and thank you so much for being here today to speak. And then Mr. Lapook?
Yeah, I think just, you know, going off that again, thank you for having me, and I would agree. I think when it comes to, you know, cancer as a force, right, it's a force that's often outside of one's control. So the question becomes, what are ways we can feel empowered in this process? You know, what are choices that are in front of us that we can make to help take care of ourselves through this process? And so I think accessing the resources that are made available from your team, really understanding what those are and figuring out who can be those advocates for you, right, so that you're supported along the way. So, you know, whether it's us or your own medical team and institution, you know, definitely reach out, learn about what resources are out there and think about how you can, you know, build the best support network and feel empowered through this process.
Thank you so much, Mr. Lapook. I want to thank all of our speakers today. You've all been so phenomenal. And I also want to thank our participants. Today's program was exceptional because of the questions asked on the Q&A and the way our speakers addressed those questions. Now, I do want to say a few words, though, for those of you who did ask a question and didn't have your question answered. I would like you to go back to your healthcare team and ask them your questions. Remember, you've learned a great deal from today's program, and I want you to take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your question again. Also, I do want to remind everybody that it is very important to know who to contact on evenings, weekends, and holidays. We often hear that that is when it is difficult to get in contact with your treating healthcare team, so you want to know who to get into contact on evenings, weekends, and holidays. And I just want to mention as well, I don't want anyone to leave this program feeling as if they are alone, because you are not alone. And I do appreciate your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.